While regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Got a great show for you, actually. In addition to our good deed of the day, our recidivist report, our armed citizen story, we're going to be spending some time talking with one of the plaintiffs in, I think this is the NRA's latest lawsuit. They might have filed another one since then. Actually, now that I think about it, I think they did file another lawsuit since then, the challenge to New York's ban on Glocks and other striker-fired handguns. Okay, so the second-to-newest lawsuit from the NRA, and two individual plaintiffs, one a Miami man, the other a resident of South Carolina, challenging the state and local laws in Colorado and Denver that working together prohibit non-residents from being able to lawfully carry, either openly or concealed, in many circumstances. Not in every circumstance, but depending on where you live, your concealed carry license may not be enough for you to carry in Colorado, because Colorado does not have universal reciprocity. And even though Colorado law says, all right, well, non-residents can openly carry, that's not true across the entirety of the state. In the city of Denver, for instance, there's an open carry ban. So how do these individuals who have concealed carry permits, just ones that aren't recognized by the state of Colorado, how can they carry? I mean, they can't without breaking the law is the gist of it. So that is going to be a fascinating case going forward. And Zachary Doherty, you know, honestly, I feel bad. I forgot to ask Zach what his last name is in the legal filings. It's Doherty. On the Zoom call that we did, it's Clark. You know him as Armed Joy on X if you follow him on social media. And he was my guest today. I had a great conversation with Zach. Take a look and a listen. Zach, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's really good to actually see you in person. I follow you on X and see you quite a bit during the weekdays when I'm on, but it's actually good to have a conversation with you, man.
Yeah, I'm always a big fan of you guys, and I like talking about all this stuff, obviously, from how much I'm on Twitter talking about it, so I'm always welcome to come on and chat.
Well, and listen, you're not just online. There are a lot of folks who talk about the Second Amendment, but you're actually very active. If folks are on X, they probably saw your videos last week. Right after the judge's stay in the Texas NFA case was lifted, you were out. Yeah, you live in South Carolina, right?
Yep. I the office I'm currently in is 5 minutes away from that store, which is kind of how that ended up happening.
Okay, so yeah, so you go out to Palmetto State Armory and are doing some, you know, on the scene reports. I have to ask, did you buy an NFA item or a former NFA item that day?
I did not, but my boss, after we got back the first time, was like, why don't I just go down there and buy one? I'm like, if you want to, you know, because obviously it's been covered to death how this is kind of legal spaghetti and you're probably fine, but there's maybe a chance you're not fine in the future. So we were like, if you want to take that risk, I'll drive you down there and we'll film you buying it and everything. And yeah, 30 minutes in and out. It was insane how fast that went. So,
and you said there was a line to the door there pretty much all day long, right?
Yeah, so we showed up about 10:03 because basically that dropped, and the night before I stayed up till 2 a.m. for work, obviously, because I work for NAGR reporting on it. And I was like, I'll just go down there and see what's happening. We had no plans, no program set up. We didn't even know if they were going to allow us to film or anything. So we're just like, we're just going to go. And we pull up and it's a ghost town outside, which was kind of, you know, we're like, huh, weird. As soon as we opened the front door, yeah, all the way from the corner all the way back is just a line of people, and they immediately brought out like a ticket machine, and they're like, okay, the line's not working, please take a ticket number. And they had this poor girl sitting there all day just pressing a button. And it was like, so it was crazy in there. And you know, the few people that came in to pick up a gun or like do normal business at PSA stores were like, what's going on? And then someone would have to explain it to them. They'd be like, oh, and they'd run over and pull a number.
That's awesome. It's like a deli. It's like an NFA right. Deli. You know,
NFA deli's good.
And one of the fascinating things about this is, you know, I think it really shows the reach of alternative media, because I mean, the mainstream media didn't really even report on this until later on in the day and even the day after. I mean, so this was word of mouth. This was people paying attention to social media And again, I mean, there was a huge response.
Yeah, and I mean, especially seeming it dropped on a weekday, work week,
Yeah.
and according to the manager of the store, there was over 100 people lined up at the door. So not only are those people who either took off work or whatever, they didn't find out until PSA was doing this until 2 in the morning. So they either stayed up or woke up really early, dropped everything, and rushed over. And there was an, to your point, there was another guy we talked to. He said he was on the freeway going south for work and had Bill Kirk's video about the NFA thing pop up, and he whipped around on the freeway, called his boss, said, "I'm going to be late," and went straight to the PSA store. And you're like, and you're right, the mainstream press and stuff didn't really catch up on this until way later in that day, and it was all, framing it as like, "Oh, the Trump administration destroyed the NFA. This is so bad," and all that nonsense. So positive reporting that didn't even hit till much later.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's again, A, it shows that we do have, I think, a large group of gun owners out there who are paying attention and are eager to find this news. I'm sure Bill Kirk loves the fact that guy was listening to him on his way to work and whipped right around. But also too, again, that the mainstream media it tends to play catch up on these issues now. So again, congratulations for your reporting. I thought it was fantastic and was able to watch that throughout the day.
Yeah, and we were the only people there. You think local press, like you don't have to go to like CNN local affiliates or anything, but even just a local outlet, that's a crazy story that somebody's just in your neighborhood just slinging NFA items out the door with no Form One. You think you'd send somebody down there, but no, it was just me with my goofy microphone mag, and that was it. That was the only person that's talking to anybody.
I mean, I think there are a couple of issues there. A, you probably had local reporters who, again, were clueless, were not aware because they're getting their cues from the national media. And then, we've talked about this a lot of times before. There just aren't a lot of gun owners. Even in local media, I mean, you're more likely to find gun owners, and I would think you're more likely to find gun owners in a pro Second Amendment state like South Carolina working in local media. But by and large, these are people who, regardless of whether or not they've got any anti-gun bias, they just don't have a lot of Second Amendment knowledge. And so I think that's one of the reasons why this flew under the radar for so long. But again, I thought it was great that you were out there, and you were the local news hound that day. It was pretty cool.
It was fun.
But you're not just exercising your First Amendment rights in support of your Second Amendment. You're also involved in litigation right now. I thought this was really cool as well. We've got a lawsuit filed last week, and you are one of the two individual plaintiffs suing over this bizarre set of this sort of confluence of state and local law in Colorado that prohibits ultimately non-residents from being able to carry in any form or fashion in the city of Denver, right?
Correct. And that, Denver's just one example. Obviously, as you reported, Alan Beck is also involved in this. And this has kind of been his bread and butter and a win he got in Hawaii. Of we all kind of know, obviously, Bruin, it's a little more complicated than this, but effectively, may and no issue is gone. You have to issue permits one way or another through some process, as long as it's not burdensome or too expensive. You have to do that. And there's a lot, and state-wise, obviously, we understand big stories like New Jersey and stuff like that, where they're opening up these processes. But there's a lot of local municipalities who either haven't updated their laws, flagrantly don't care, and are flaunting that they're not going to update these laws, or even something as simple as the processes and website and their tools, they just never updated it for this whatsoever. So there's places where you'll go to apply for a permit and there will be a drop-down menu and there will be no states in it besides the state that is listed. So it's
Right.
like, how do you, well, town, I guess, or city. And it's like, okay, well, you literally can't apply in that case unless you drive there, maybe talk to a sheriff, and then who knows if their in-person systems are valid. So it effectively bans you from carrying. And that was the issue that I ran into because, like I said, I work for NAGR and we're currently headquartered in South Carolina, but we still have a satellite HQ in Loveland where we moved from originally. And we work with RMGO, which is the Colorado Rocky Mountain Gun Owners, a lot. And that requires me to go out there and go to Denver. Now, when I lived in Colorado, I had my, Colorado permit and stuff like that. I could do that. They had reciprocity and we could figure it out. Now that I don't live there, we realized, oh, just you're screwed. There's nothing you can do. And thankfully I have some nice lawyer friends and stuff like that. And I'm like, hey, what if we take a shot at fixing this? So
And so here we are.
Yeah, it is weird because I mean, so Colorado, you can't get a non-resident permit, right? That's problem number one. And then they only recognize they have reciprocity with a number of states, but like if you've got a Utah permit, but you're not a Utah resident, they don't care, right? They only recognize some out-of-state permits, but you have to be a resident of that state in
And
order for it.
it's not clear if Denver recognizes the same permits that Colorado recognizes, that it's a rat's nest of implications, you know.
Right. And so if you want to open carry, you can as a non-resident throughout some of Colorado, but not in Denver, because Denver has an open carry ban for everybody, residents and non-residents alike,
Yeah,
right?
so the legal carve out, they could have argued, you have, oh, well, you can open carry. Well, no, you have a local ordinance against that too. So you effectively, it becomes, not even may issue, it becomes no issue, because there's no meaningful way to make this happen and how all these laws intersect.
Yeah, which is going to be fascinating, because I know that I mean, Alan's done a great job. And I think there are a lot of local governments in Hawaii, whenever they see the filing, they're just like, oh, okay, we're gonna fix things, thanks, Alan.
I think it's Costas who introduces him as the future king of Hawaii, because eventually
Right.
he's just going to own the state. He continues to beat them so frequently.
Yeah, but this is a little different. I mean, I suppose the Denver City Council could rescind its ban on open carry. I don't think that's likely to happen. I suppose the state of Colorado could provide the fix that, okay, we'll recognize, all these permits from out of state, as long as you've got reciprocity with the state. It doesn't matter if it's a resident or non-resident permit. I don't know how likely the legislature is to do that, quite honestly. I think that, this is clearly a problem under the Second Amendment, under what the Supreme Court has said. I just don't know that the politicians in Colorado are willing to fix it.
And particularly Denver, they've been obstinate, as we saw with the DOJ lawsuit over there, where they basically responded like, kick rocks. And it's like,
Right.
if they're doing that to the DOJ, yeah, I doubt they're going to move anything for this. They're going to think they can fight it out. But obviously I'm biased. I think we're going to do great. I think they're going to lose horribly. So we'll see how this all shakes out.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think this is an important case because, again, right now, the Second Amendment is the only right that stops at the border of your home state. And I don't even like the idea of, okay, well, you as a non-resident can apply for a non-resident permit, because we've seen how states like Massachusetts have screwed with that issue. Like, you've got to go and apply in person, right? You cannot just do this online. They want you to travel to Massachusetts. So it's a very expensive endeavor. It's a time-consuming endeavor. Again, it's not something that you have to go through when exercising any other right. But I think this lawsuit could move the ball forward in a very big way. So I'm glad that you're involved in this. I think that you and Glenn Howland, is he the other individual plaintiff? Is that his name?
Yes, and then if I remember correctly, the NRA itself is also listed as a
Yeah.
plaintiff.
So again, I think this is a fantastic lawsuit. And we are making real progress, which brings me kind of the last topic that I wanted to bring up with you. One of the things that I love about following you on X and Armed Joy, with a zero for the O in Joy, you talk about the Second Amendment doomerism that we have, and certainly it's not everybody, but there are. I mean, I ran into this last week where every bit of good news is greeted with, yeah, but it's not good enough. We still have the NFA. I even saw somebody, I'm not gonna name their handle, but they just like Heller and McDonald and Bruin, this decision, the Silencer Shop decision, it's an empty victory. And one step forward, two steps back. And I just want to say, dude, at first I thought he was sarcastic, and I wasn't even going to respond. And I'm pretty sure he was actually serious about this, because he's not the only one making this argument.
It makes you feel like you live in a different reality than a lot of people,
Yeah, I mean,
which
where do you think this comes from, Zach?
I think it's kind of like three things going on here. One, it's something I point out all the time, but keep in mind when you're on social media that a lot of people that like to talk about guns don't actually own guns themselves. They just like the political conversation around guns, so they might not even be aware of how things used to be compared to now. And then obviously there's people in blue states that are just kind of screwed, and we can't really be mad at them for that. Every good thing that happens does kind of come with an asterisk on them. But even then, like, for example, Bruin didn't mean anything. You can get a gun permit in New Jersey. People don't remember that you used to have to know a guy or slide a $100 bill to a sheriff to get a gun permit in New Jersey. Nobody was getting those at all. And now it's some absurd number like 200,000 processed, or I'd forget the exact number, but
Yeah,
it's
over
ridiculous.
200,000.
And so that's a notable change in a deep blue state, that something is happening. Now, places like California or New York might be more annoying, but there's still changes happening there. And even though it hasn't come to fruition like it is in New Jersey, you have the DOJ stepping in and suing these places, which, comes to the third thing of just the knowledge gap all the time. Because I'll post, like, for, keeping on the DOJ, like, wow, the DOJ is suing the city of Denver. That's crazy. And somebody will be like, when are they going to do Illinois next? They don't do anything for us. And it's like, they already did a lawsuit for Illinois like 6 months ago. You just didn't hear it. So there's a lot of knowledge bubbles because this all goes fast, but that's where I end being generous with these people too, is also there's just a lot of crybabies that they just want to be mad and want nothing to ever go the way, and they have a victim complex where things need to be horrible and falling apart. And there's might even be some elements of concern trolling, if people are familiar with that term, where people pretend to be on your side and just be negative and defeatist the whole time to try to demoralize you. So it's social media. There's probably a degree of that going on as well. And it frustrates me to no end, because just like in that post I made, I was born in 93. As soon as I was 1 year old, I couldn't own any gun that's in my house right now. They would all be illegal. I could not. In Michigan, it was may issue, effectively no issue for the majority of my life. And now I can go home, and it's a purple state, and it's one going blue quickly. I can still own an FRT. I can still 3D print guns. I can own an AR-15. I can get a suppressor shipped to my front door. You still have to do a tax stamp and everything, unfortunately, because stupid Michigan ordinances. But still, like, from when I was born to now, it is night and day. And yet people still kind of act like we're living under like a federal assault weapons ban, or it's the 80s. And it's just not, objectively, even in the most blue states, things are better now than they were in 94. I think people just get tripped up on it because the assault weapons ban sunsetted, and then we had like a brief period where everyone jumped forward. And then everyone else kept jumping forward, and a few blue states went back to the status quo. But it's still advancement from where it was. We're still objectively better nationwide than we've ever been and might ever be.
Absolutely. I think the best is yet to come. I mean, I do think that, but I started doing Cam and Company in 2004, so that was 4 years before the Heller decision. And it's remarkable to me that we have people who are now old enough to buy a firearm who weren't even born. When the Heller decision came down. So the only world that they know is that post-Heller environment. But honestly, to me, it seems to be the majority of the folks that I see who are sort of the doomers, they're old enough to have been around in the pre-Heller era.
They should know better.
They should. I mean, and there is that, I mean, look, there's the attitude of, well, as long as the NFA is still around and the ATF still around, as long as I can't buy a machine gun, then it's all BS. And those are the folks who, again, just want to complain, I think, right? Or at least don't want to acknowledge political and legal realities. I think you're right, though, that there is this knowledge bubble. And part of that is because, I mean, when you look at groups like National Association of Gun Rights, NRA, Gun Owners of America, Second Amendment Foundation, Citizens Committee, I'm probably leaving out one or two major groups.
Yeah,
The
there's a
amount
list.
of litigation that is underway right now, just active litigation. We're talking about dozens and dozens of cases. So when somebody, and I think your attitude is spot on. When somebody says, "Yeah, well, what is the DOJ doing in Illinois?" Don't immediately jump down their throat. I had this last week. Somebody asked about NRA. Well, what's NRA doing in Illinois? And I said, "Well, here are the cases that the NRA is involved in Illinois."
Yeah, they have a pile. And I always, because this one is the biggest highlight for me that drives me nuts, is people are saying, where are the gun groups and the lawsuits for felon in possession charges, or misdemeanor charges that lose your gun rights? And I have to explain to them, like, the Supreme Court denies probably like 300 cases a year on that.
Yeah.
There's so many lawsuits going on that issue. I don't even think you could track all of them if you tried.
Right. Yeah, but you look at a case like Melinda Vincent, who's the woman in Utah who had a, I think wrote a bad check, 20 years ago. I think almost every major Second Amendment group filed an amicus brief in her defense, urging the court to take her case. They didn't ultimately. They denied that case along with, virtually, as you say, virtually every other G1 case. But that's not the fault of the Second Amendment groups. That's not the fault of 2A advocates. That's the
Yeah,
Supreme
not only
Court
are
not
people
wanting to get
banging on
into
that,
this issue.
yeah, not only people are banging on that door, the line goes around the block. There's everyone's public defenders are trying that. Every single group has a lawsuit on that. Local groups have a lawsuit on that. Like everyone's trying. And that's kind of the case with everything there's this misunderstanding that you can just sue harder and it'll make a difference. You just
Right.
make more cases, and at some point you have enough cases, it goes over the top. To where there's an assault weapons ban lawsuit in every single state that has them, multiple of them. Every single gun issue you could imagine, from being taxed to permitting to where you can carry to how you can carry to the NFA, there's more lawsuits than I know of, and it's my job partially to track all this stuff. It's insane. And so it's not really their fault in a sense to not know all these things, but you have to explain this to people so often of there is an entire world of litigation and beyond litigation, bills and proposals and amendments being proposed all over the place constantly.
Yeah, and it's not an even playing field, right? I mean, there are obviously some circuits that I think are more friendly to our arguments. I've talked with Jim Wallace from the Gun Owners Action League up in Massachusetts on multiple occasions. He says, the First Circuit is like beating your head against the wall, like even more hostile than the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so, his challenge and the challenge for Second Amendment groups in a place like Massachusetts. Do you want to, do you essentially want to waste, millions of dollars knowing you're going to lose at the district court, maybe, or at least at the appellate court level, right? Maybe you'll get a good decision like we got in, I think it was Beckwith versus Frye, the waiting period in Maine. District judge says, yeah, this violates the Second Amendment. First Circuit comes in and says, no, it doesn't. So do you want to commit yourself to, okay, we have to take this case up to the Supreme Court. We know it's going to cost, $1 million or more.
And
And we
the
know we're
money thing
likely to
to
lose.
yeah, the money thing to highlight on, I think that's the other thing people just don't understand is lawsuits aren't free, and lawsuits aren't even cheap. Like you're right, like $1 million per case. And yeah, who's paying for that? Because we don't get that delicious state money to argue everything like our oppositions do. We're paying for this out of pocket. The example, great, bringing up Alan Beck in Hawaii, they were fundraising on GoFundMe to pay for their own Supreme Court case because they were getting no money. So.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, I wish we had a Michael Bloomberg on our side. I wish Elon Musk would open up his pocketbook and write us a 8-figure check and that'd be great. But we don't have that. We've got folks who are making $10, $15 donations to help fund these lawsuits. And in that sense, we're probably still the underdog. I think that we've got the better legal arguments. I do think that we've got a Supreme Court that broadly accepts and recognizes, yes, the right to keep arms is a real thing. Are they moving as fast as we'd like? No. Could it be a lot worse? But I think we are in a, let's put it this way. I would rather be in our shoes right now than in the gun control lobby's shoes. Do you agree?
Yes, and I mean I highlight this another thing I love to hit on of how desperate and deflated they currently seem to be at the moment, because they're even open and admitting their fundraising is down. March for Our Lives fired all their employees and now are run by like two people in a shed or something like that, and they're losing this momentum. And I to the doomering and the blackpilling point. The youth in particular, like if you're under the age of 30, even if you're under the age of like 25, they have almost completely moved away from the gun control argument. They are either exceedingly pro-gun, more so than even the older generations, or even if they're Democrats or leftists or whatever, they'll talk about it and be like, yeah, I like gun control, but then they just don't really actually care. They won't donate to these groups, they won't show up to protests, they won't testify at a bill committee. It's just the AstroTurf, that they bring those people out. Local wise, nobody really cares. And that's even more important than the litigation or election victories or whatever. Culturally, we've absolutely dominated the gun control argument, and it's only getting better with time because that youth is going to grow up. They're going to get more money to buy more guns, to join groups, to donate. They'll have more time and political capital to show up to hearings and protests. And you're already kind of seeing that where I covered heavily the Rhode Island assault weapons ban, the AR-15 confiscation bill, and there was a surprising amount of young people that would not look anything like us and would not fit in at any kind of gun convention. And you would look at them and they'd be like, "Oh, that's the pro-gun control testimony." And then they come up stage and it's like, "No, actually, this is horrible and awful, and we should never pass this bill." And that's just going to get better with time.
Yeah, we saw that a little bit in Minnesota this year too with the gun ban bill. And I think, right before we started talking, I was working on a story about the FBI's Crime in the United States 2025 report, which was dropped on a Friday afternoon for some reason. I don't know why, because this is historic good news. And I think this is one of the other problems that the gun control lobby has is for decades, this has been premised on the idea that more guns equals more crime, right? And we have more guns in this country than we've ever had before. Some estimates, 500 million firearms. We have the lowest recorded homicide rate since at least 1956, probably in the past 125 years. And right now, crime murders down another 18% so far this year. I mean, we're looking at a national homicide rate right now in 2026. I think this year's was or 2025 was 4.1 per 100,000 people. If that pace continues, 3.5 per 100,000 people. I mean, there literally has never been a safer moment in U.S. history. While more than half the country is permitless carry, right? While we have 500 million firearms in this country, while bans on so-called assault weapons are being challenged, and the AR-15 is the most popular rifle in the country, the fundamental premise of gun control just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it just doesn't.
Yeah, it's the other thing we highlight all the time. How many times can they promise blood in the streets and widespread chaos and crime is going to go up whenever a pro-gun thing happens, and then it just doesn't, and it just keeps going down. And we can debate whether the guns are helping that crime go down or there it's just a neutral factor, but it's overwhelmingly obvious that it's not a negative one. We are, bringing up my own age again, the 90s and the 80s were way more violent and chaotic than most people remember. And compared to now, like our parents, our grandparents, the country they grew up in, infinitely more violent. And now all this gun control is going away, and we live in this extraordinarily peaceful time. And not just, ownership, but I think I posted about it last week of John Lott did a survey through another company, a blind survey of voters. And it came out that something like one in three people are willing to admit to a pollster that they conceal carry a firearm every single day. And that's way, way up from where we were talking, in the 50s and 60s, where 50 something percent of people wanted a total ban on handguns. So you can talk about a complete Overton window shift.
Absolutely. Well, Zach, if folks want to follow you on X or social media, where can they find you?
So yeah, I'm Armjoy. That's my personal Twitter account where I'm a little bit of a wild boy on there. But then I also run the social media account for National Association for Gun Rights, and that's just Gun Rights on Twitter and Facebook. So you can find me there.
So you are the guy behind the NAGR social media. All right. Well, that's good to know. Well, Zach, listen, I really appreciate your time. Give our best to the rest of the folks at the NAGR offices and look forward to talking to you again in the future, man.
I appreciate it. I look forward to it.
My thanks to Zach for joining us on the program. And again, I'd like to say great conversation, a variety of topics. But I think all of them, again, very, very important. All right. On to today's Armed Citizen story. Our good deed of the day and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a disturbing case out of Michigan. This is the headline from People magazine. A Michigan man who allegedly killed five had a violent history, including a child abuse conviction and, quote, extremely aggressive behavior. As I said, this is just absolutely tragic. This individual accused of killing five people and then taking his own life in a series of shootings, multiple locations in the state of Michigan. Had a long history of violence and, quote, aggressive behavior. The shootings took place on August 14th. The suspect, Chad Hickman, had a criminal record, including a misdemeanor child abuse conviction, as well as domestic violence allegations tied to his divorce. It was just 2 years ago that the 39-year-old pleaded guilty to one count of fourth-degree child abuse and one count of contributing to the delinquency of a minor in connection with a 2010 child abuse case in Misaukee County, according to the Detroit News. Now, here's where this, you know, the recidivist report comes into play here. At the time, Hickman had been charged with several misdemeanor and felony charges, including assault with intent to do great bodily harm, less than murder by strangulation, two counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct, pretty serious charges that were dropped in exchange for Hickman taking this plea deal. One misdemeanor count of fourth-degree child abuse, one count of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. And instead of being sentenced to a lengthy prison term, had he been convicted at trial, a judge sentenced Hickman to a year in the county jail in connection with the case. And again, time off for good behavior, time off for any time that was served while he was awaiting trial, factored in. So Hickman served less than a year. He was also facing domestic violence allegations during his divorce from his ex-wife, Katie Hickman. They separated in 2023. They tried reconciling before divorcing in 2025. Both had level claims of domestic violence at each other, according to a Misaukee County judge. But again, to me, the biggest red flag here, and you know, there are neighbors or people who knew him who said that he had, again, this history of aggressive behavior. To me, the biggest red flag is you've got somebody who's accused of very serious violent crimes. And instead of pursuing those felony charges that he was accused of, prosecutors instead offered him a plea deal, and one that resulted in very little to time behind bars. Now, you could argue that, okay, well, maybe the evidence wasn't that strong. I mean, this was a case from 2010. He didn't go to, you know, he wasn't charged until 2023 or 2024. There was enough evidence, even though it was 14 years later, there was enough evidence for prosecutors to charge him. There was enough evidence to allow for a preliminary hearing and for this case to go forward. So there wasn't no evidence. Again, we don't know whether there are people who are willing to testify. Again, that's often one of the considerations when you're talking about child abuse or particularly a sexual abuse. Do you want to put that victim through that experience again? Do you want to make them, you know, relive what happened on the witness stand? Do you want them to have to face adversarial questions from the defense attorney? And, you know, I'm not saying that those questions are invalid. But what I am saying is that if the answer to those questions is no, we don't want to put the victim through that. No, we don't want them to have to face that kind of questioning. No, we don't want them to go through, you know, again, a very emotional and perhaps even psychologically harmful experience. Well, the result is that somebody who is accused and possibly guilty of this behavior will not face consequences for those acts. That's the trade-off. And it is a, to me, again, that's a real trade-off. And that is a real concern. So there was an opportunity to pursue these charges. Prosecutors didn't. Maybe they feel like they've got a good reason for it. But, you know, they say hindsight's 20/20. And in retrospect, I wonder if these prosecutors still believe that that plea deal was in the best interest of justice. On to today's armed citizen story from Manassas, Virginia, where prosecutors have dropped a murder charge against a Manassas woman after an audio recording introduced reasonable doubt and a strong piece of evidence supporting her claim of self-defense. Latoya Crabb was charged with first-degree murder in the October 25 shooting death of her husband, Curtis Crabb. She had asked Curtis for a divorce. She has maintained from the beginning that she acted in self-defense. That didn't matter to prosecutors. Again, she was arrested. She was charged. But now prosecutors say an audio recording of the events leading up to the shooting introduces, quote, significant evidence supporting that claim of self-defense and creates reasonable doubt about criminal intent. The development, according to WUSA in Washington, D.C., came after prosecutors, the defense attorneys, and the judge listened in court to a roughly five-hour audio recording that LaToya Crabb had made of a conversation between herself and her estranged husband. Crabb's attorney, David Doherty, said the recording captures what he believes is the sound of Curtis Crabb pulling out a knife moments before the shooting. Her mother, Marilyn Martin, said what's on this tape is what she told us happened. She says that in the nearly 2 years since her daughter has been arrested, her daughter and the rest of the family have gone through just an exhausting experience. Crabb's three young children were home at the time of the shooting. Crabb's mom maintains that her daughter was trying to protect herself and her children. She said she was faced with a situation where she had to save her life and the life of her children. According to LaToya Crabb's mom, her daughter had alerted authorities to the audio recording, which she made to document a conversation between the couple. Conversation escalated, included verbal and physical threats, including with a knife by Curtis Crabb, before again it ended with the sound of gunshots. Doherty, the defense attorney, said the sound that it makes when he pulls the knife out, he says it's something right out of a cartoon. He said it's unmistakable. I'm guessing that shing sound, right? He said he's frustrated that it took this long for the recording to become a key piece of evidence in the case. And while prosecutors have dropped the charges against LaToya Crabb, they did not do so in a way that precludes them from bringing them forward again. So the case could theoretically be prosecuted in the future. Her attorney says, I don't look as happy as you'd think after a two-year-long case like this ends favorably. The Commonwealth's attorney released a statement saying, in part, a prosecutor's highest ethical duty is to seek justice, which requires a continuous and objective evaluation of all evidence throughout the life of a case. Our office is legally and ethically bound to proceed only with prosecutions where the available evidence can prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. In preparation for trial, prosecutors and investigators from the Manassas City Police Department successfully accessed a previously unexamined audio recording recovered from a digital device seized during the investigation. Which makes it sound like, you know, they had trouble doing this before. Like, we successfully accessed a previously unexamined audio recording that had been recovered from a digital device. Okay, well, why wasn't this examined before? Because it sounds like LaToya Crabb and her attorneys wanted this evidence to be examined before. The Commonwealth's attorney says the five-hour recording captured the extensive conversations and events immediately leading up to the shooting incident. Following an exhaustive review of the audio and its transcript, the Commonwealth has concluded that the recording introduces significant evidence that a reasonable jury could interpret as supporting a claim of lawful self-defense. And because this new evidence creates a reasonable doubt regarding criminal intent, the Commonwealth cannot ethically proceed with the prosecution at this time, which is a very long way of saying the evidence now supports her claim of self-defense. And again, that evidence, to me anyway, could have been introduced long before now and should have been a part of the initial investigation. I am curious as to why it was not. But I don't know that we're going to get any answers for that. For LaToya Crabb, though, the open murder charge has been dismissed. And hopefully she can start to move forward with her life without those criminal charges hanging over her head. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time will enable to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in Salisbury, Massachusetts, who rescued a man from a burning home on Friday night, saying that he just wanted to get the guy out. This was a very scary situation. From Channel 7 News in Boston, at WHDH, Ron Pearson is the good Samaritan in question, but not the only good Samaritan. He says he and others rushed to the aid of people who were trapped in this raging fire. He said it was really scary. He said, but I just tried to get the old man out, so I grabbed him. He said, flames are going everywhere. Things are falling. He said, wood's on fire. There are two cars there. There are gas tanks or propane tanks. He said, you know, these things are really just scary to be around fire. He said, but I wanted to make sure that man got out safely. And he was able to pull this gentleman out of the burning multi-story blaze on Friday night. Suffered severe burns to his arms in doing so. Fire officials say that two people, including the man that Pearson helped rescue, were taken to the hospital to be treated for non-life-threatening burns and smoke inhalation. The cause of the fire remains under investigation, but no lives lost, again, in large part because of Ron Pearson and those other Good Samaritans who came to the aid of strangers in need there on Atlantic Avenue in Salisbury, Mass. On Friday night. And Ron Pearson, we thank you for your very, very good deed. Speaking of Massachusetts, we're going to be talking with our friend Toby Leary from Cape Gunworks on tomorrow's Bearing Arms Cam and Company, so be sure to tune in for that. We'll also have another Armed Citizen store for you and much more. And be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today. We are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation, including that great news from the FBI that I talked about, violent crime down to an almost 60-year low. Homicides, again, the lowest since at least 1956, 58, probably closer to the lowest in more than a century. And again, that does leave the arguments of the gun control advocates in tatters. More guns leads to more crime, they say. It's not what we're seeing across the United States. Have a great rest of your Monday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.